We're continuing our study this morning of worship. We've talked about how God is the only one true God, worthy of our worship, His nature, His character, His deeds. Everything about Him demand and call for the deepest reverence and respect for His holy character and name. We talked a couple of weeks ago about what worship consists of. Fundamentally, in the Hebrew language as well as in the Greek language, the word for worship in both of those languages, interestingly enough, at its very root means to fall down, to bow down, to kneel down. And of course, in a world such as they lived in which they had kings and emperors and rulers of all kinds, those individuals lived in great magnificence. And anyone who came into their presence was expected to fall down on their knees before them. And that concept helps us understand something about how we all come into the presence of God. And while we've sat comfortably in our pews today, in our hearts, we should have been bowed down before Him. And we're bowed down now as we worship Him. I really appreciated in Rodney's prayer a few moments ago, His mentioning the offerings we bring even now of praise and honor to Him as we sing these songs and have these prayers and gather around the table together. For those are the offerings now that God accepts and sacrifice before Him. This morning I want us to talk about one other aspect of worship. Now when I say one other, I'm not implying that this is the end of the story. We still have more to come. But I want to raise for us this morning what I consider a very interesting subject. And that is, when we talk about worship, what can we learn about worship from Jesus? I've thought at various times about having some other subjects like that. What can we learn about worship from the patriarchs? What can we learn about worship from the prophets? What can we learn about worship from the Psalms? But I'm not going to try to drag this series out too long, and while I raise those subjects for your attention, this time around at least, it's not something we'll actually be looking at. But we do this morning want to look at what we can learn about worship from Jesus. Next week, with God's help, we'll be talking about what can we learn about worship from the early church. Then our final lesson in the series probably will be what can we learn about worship from the book of Revelation. We truly want to be worshipers of God. We want to learn all we can about how to worship and how others worshiped in ways that was acceptable to God. Worship is the only appropriate response when man learns about God. The scriptures tell us that there's enough evidence for God that men can know of His greatness and magnificence. Now, it's hard for us, it would be impossible, in fact, for us to know of God's will separate and apart from His revelation. And in fact, God has revealed not just His existence to us, but His very will. In the words of God, He spoke through prophets and patriarchs, and last of all, through Jesus and through His apostles to us. And so God has revealed not only His existence and His magnificence, but His very will to us. But even for those who have not yet discovered that, we still see people who seek to worship God. When we look at other religions, those who don't see the Bible as a revelation from God, and even those who don't even see the God of the Bible as the only one true God, we nevertheless see people who recognize the importance of worshiping a supreme being. This has been true as long as human history has been kept. Even as we read through the scriptures in the Old Testament, we spend most of our time when we look at the other gods mentioned in the Bible in thinking about that being idolatry and something God condemned. But if we think for just a moment, we at least recognize that all mankind has acknowledged that the supreme being ought to be worshipped, even if they totally misunderstood who He was or what His will was. The truth is, mankind as a race of creatures are worshiping beings. Every one of us from the very beginning of time has recognized the necessity of acknowledging the supreme being and giving Him that which is His due, our reverence and respect. I find it interesting that even those who claim not to believe in a supreme being nevertheless worship something. They give credit to something as being supreme. Even those who consider themselves agnostic or even atheist, by and large, those people acknowledge knowledge or science or even human inventiveness as being that which ought to be acknowledged as supreme. They may well worship science as being all-powerful and all-knowing and all-capable. While they might worship knowledge as being that thing that all men ought to come to and give their devotion to, as being the most desirable thing for all people to have. Because by our very nature, we are worshipers. And if we don't worship the one true God, we'll worship something else. And history bears that out. But God has revealed Himself. And He's not only revealed Himself and His will, He has revealed Himself on the subject of worship. And while we're not going to take a great deal of time from this point forward in our study, looking in the Old Testament, we see there, nevertheless, God ordaining things like altars and sacrifices and holy days and tabernacles and temples and rituals as the appropriate ways for Him to be honored and revered. Then when we come down to the New Testament, we have a very interesting thing happen. The God who spoke from heaven through inspired men all through the Old Testament has chosen to come down and live among us in the person of Jesus Christ. God, as it says in Colossians chapter 2, God has become flesh and dwelt among us. If God revealed Himself in the Old Testament about worship and the ways that He did, what has He revealed to us in the New? Through His very presence among us in Jesus, His Son. Now He speaks from down here, not just up there. Now He's not only going to tell us what to do, He's going to show us, and He's going to tell us both how and why. So what does Jesus tell us about worship? Usually when we think of that, we think first and foremost about what He's taught us. What did He say about worship? And when we start talking about that, the very first thing that comes to at least my mind, and maybe yours as well, is that story in John chapter 4, when Jesus has chosen to pass through Samaria. He even says that it was necessary for Him to go through Samaria. And that's a very interesting statement, because the Jewish people as a whole went out of their way, literally, to not go through Samaria. The people who lived in Samaria were sort of a mixed race of people, it seems. Part of them were the descendants of the ancient Israelites who had once lived there. But they were mixed in over many generations, both racially and by marriage and in every other kind of way. They were mixed in with the original peoples who had lived in that land, plus peoples who had come in from ancient Assyria and had settled in that land over the centuries. And because they were a mixed race of people, their religion also was a mixed religion. It was partially Jewish in some ways. They actually believed that the five books of Moses in the Old Testament was from God. They believed that He ought to be worshipped. They actually built a temple to worship Him on a mountain called Gerizim. But they had also mixed in many of the religious practices and beliefs of the idolatrous people who had become a part of that land. And so while they had this temple and they had these five books of Moses, they did many things and believed many things that had nothing to do with the God of the Bible. And so the Jewish people avoided them. They were sort of a necessary evil. They couldn't do anything about them being up there, but they didn't have to do anything with them. They could avoid them. And they did. And yet it tells us in the Scriptures that Jesus had to go through Samaria. Now, He didn't have to go through there because that was the only way to get to Jerusalem. He didn't have to go through there because that was the only way to go from Galilee down to Judea. He had to go through there because He had to take care of some business. He had to tell these people about God's grace and mercy. I'm sure his disciples were not too happy about this. They were still very prejudiced people. Even though they were following Jesus, they were constantly shocked and troubled, I think, even by how Jesus was non-discriminatory. He was just as willing to deal with a Roman centurion or a Syrophoenician woman or someone from Samaria as he was Jewish people. Because he wasn't discriminatory. God's grace was for all. So when they come down through Samaria, it tells us they reached a certain place near a small town called Sychar. And this Sychar had two interesting things about it. Number one, it was located at a place where a well had been dug all the way back in the days of Jacob. Remember who Jacob was? He was the one that God renamed Israel, and that's where Israel actually got its name from. They were all descendants of Jacob. Through his 12 sons, the 12 tribes of Israel came. And he had actually dug a well there at this place where Sychar was, so they could have water. That was one interesting thing about it. The second interesting thing was about it, it was located where, if you just looked off, not even very far in the distance, there was Mount Gerizim. You could see the place where the Samaritan people worshipped. Now, Mount Gerizim was known for something a long time before the Samaritans had built a temple there. It was actually the place fairly soon after the Israelites had first came into this land in the days of Joshua, where they had stood between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And they had assembled in the valley in between those two mountains. And they had heard the reading of the law of God, and they had pledged themselves to be his people once again, once he had given them the land. And so it was a very historic place. Even though the Jews mostly chose to avoid it simply because the Samaritans living there, they actually would have benefited a great deal by visiting there to remind themselves of their own history. So when they reached this place, Sychar, to sort of shorten up the story a little bit, Jesus sits down there by the well while his disciples go into Sychar to try to find food. Jesus never did a miracle to provide for himself. Even though we know he can multiply loaves and fishes, and he fed 5,000 or more on one occasion, over 4,000 on another, he never once made food for himself. The devil tried to tempt him with that at his temptation, but he wasn't successful. And so Jesus, hungry and tired, sits at the well, while his disciples, also hungry and tired, go into town to try to find food. And here comes a woman out from the town to draw water. And he engages her in conversation. He asks her for a drink of water. And she can tell right away he's Jewish, maybe by his language and probably by his dress, that he was Jewish. And so she says, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask me, a Samaritan, for a drink of water?" She's used to being totally snubbed and discriminated against by Jews, what few times she ever saw one. Jesus' answer was most interesting, wasn't it? He said, "If you knew who it was who was asking you for a drink of water, you would ask him for a drink of water." Now that certainly had to sort of pique her curiosity. What in the world is this fella talking about? They've immediately gotten off the whole subject of her being Samaritan and him being Jewish, and she just wants to know, what is this riddle he is giving me? And of course, the rest of the story, as we could read it there in John chapter 4, finally comes down to the point where she says, "Sir, I can see that you're a prophet." And she says, "Our fathers worshipped on this mountain." She has to be pointing to Gerizim. "But you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem." And Jesus answered, "Believe me, woman, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem." Again, another paradox, a riddle, something that seemed to be totally different than what she had always heard. "You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth." Jesus tells her several things here about worship, and it's this passage that perhaps most of us think of when we think about the idea of what did Jesus tell us about worship. Look at the things he tells us. Number one, he tells her, and therefore us, that a geographical place is no longer important when it comes to worshiping God. Now, at one time it was, because God had told specifically the Jewish people where he put his name, that's where they were to build a place to worship him. And that was in Jerusalem. And so that's where they built, that's first of all where they moved the Ark of the Covenant in the days of David, and then later in the days of his son Solomon, they built a temple to worship him. And that's where a temple was in Jesus' day, in Jerusalem, to worship God. She would naturally expect him to tell her that Jerusalem was the right place, because after all, he was Jewish. But no, he tells her that the geographical place is no longer important. She thought there was only two possible answers, either Gerizim or Jerusalem. And he says, no, there's a third answer, and it's the right one. The place geographically is no longer important. Secondly, he tells her that the time has now come for this change to take place. Not just the change about where you worship him geographically, but even the change of how you worship him. Up until this time, God had been worshipped in Jerusalem at a temple with altars, holy days, sacrifices, rituals, special priesthood. Just the list goes on and on. But Jesus says the change is now. That God now looks for true worshipers who worship him in spirit and in truth. What does he mean by that? I'm not sure I'm smart enough to fully understand it. I know some have suggested when he said worship in spirit, he meant worship from the heart. But you know, in the Old Testament, he expected people to worship him from the heart as well. He would say through the prophets that he rejected their sacrifices and offerings and keeping of their holy days and Sabbath days because their heart wasn't in it. And so we know that even in the Old Testament, he expected people to worship him from the heart. But maybe the clue is this. He says, God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit. He appeals to the very nature of God himself. Up until that time, they had worshiped God through what? Material things. Through a material place, a material city, material altars, material sacrifices, keeping of literal physical holy days, keeping specific rituals. But he said, God is a spirit. And those who truly worship him are going to worship him in spirit. Now, I know that includes our hearts or our spirits, but I think he's saying more than that. I think he's saying we're going to worship him in spiritual things, not physical. And I think the other part of his statement goes right along with that, and he says, in truth. Now, at first we might think he just means that we're going to worship him according to his truth, what he said, and that is certainly true. But again, the Jewish people were already doing that. They were worshiping him according to his word and his commandments because they were making sacrifices and they had altars and they kept the Passover and Pentecost and tabernacle and Sabbath days. Those were all according to God's command, so they were already worshiping him in truth that way. But let me suggest to you that maybe a better English word than truth, and I'm not trying to change God's words here, or Jesus' words, but maybe the better understanding of what Jesus is saying is we need that the time has come and now is when we worship him in the spiritual and according to the true. What is the true? Think for a moment about all those things in the Old Testament. They were physical instead of in the spirit. Even though they were spiritual, they were not spiritual things, except in the sense God had designated them so. But they were also what? They were all foreshadowings of what was to come, the true. That physical altar was only a foretelling of a spiritual altar. Those physical sacrifices were only foreshadowings of a spiritual sacrifice that Jesus himself would make once and for all. That incense they offered back there, while physical, was only a foreshadowing of the spiritual incense of our praise and our prayers that we now offer up to God. I believe Jesus was telling this woman in words she probably had no way of fully grasping yet, and we still struggle to understand. that true worshipers of God are those who worship God in spiritual things according to the true things God has designated. All those things in the Old Testament were only things pointing to the true and the spiritual. And think about how God has made those things come about. We don't worship at a physical temple anymore in a geographical place. We worship in a spiritual temple, which it says in Ephesians chapter 2, starting in verse 19, is the church. It is the true. It is the spiritual. The temple in Jerusalem was the physical. And while it was built according to the truth, it was only the foreshadowing. It was not the real temple of God. That's true of everything that we do as God's people today. We're worshiping according to the spiritual and according to the true. So that's one thing we can learn from Jesus about worship, is that God is looking for people who worship Him not in a specific geographical place and not primarily based upon what they do physically in terms of their acts of worship. I'm not saying physical things are not important, but it's not primarily the focus anymore on those physical things. Those physical things all are pointing to spiritual realities that God really intends for people to be doing in worship to Him. But we also hear Jesus saying in a passage like Matthew chapter 15, and another teaching of His, that people can worship God in vain. The word vain simply means not the way we use it today. We talk about someone who's vain, who is more concerned about their looks and appearance and what other people think about them. That's not the meaning of the word vain in the Bible. The word vain in the Bible meant empty, useless, without any content. And Jesus said in Matthew chapter 15, He's talking to these Jewish people about how they had changed some of the commandments of God to suit themselves. And He says, "You hypocrites," verse 7, "Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you. These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain because their teachings are but rules taught by men." Jesus is telling them that when they changed what God said to suit themselves and then tried to worship Him using these changed commandments, their worship became empty. This lets us know that worship is not something we choose in how we do it. It's not optional in terms of how. We do it as God specifies it. If God specifies that the church is His temple, then we can only honor Him in it. It tells us in Ephesians chapter 3 concerning the church, "Now to Him be glory and praise forever in the church." That's the place God has now designated that He is glorified. And glorified is just one aspect of worship. But these people had made their worship empty or fruitless because of the way they had changed it. And His disciples couldn't understand this because they then come to Him afterwards and says, "Don't you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard you say this?" His own disciples, not understanding it, said, "Jesus, you offended the Pharisees." What did Jesus say? "Oh, I'm sorry, let me go apologize to them?" I don't think so. He tells His disciples that you are missing the same thing they are. That what makes a person right with God is not what you're doing on the outside, but what's on the inside. That unless the heart is right, whatever's going to come out of the heart out to the outside is not going to be pleasing to God. This is Jesus telling us something about worship. We can sing all the right songs. We can gather around the table. We can have prayer. We can contribute. All things we know that the early church did as a part of their worship to God. But unless our hearts are engaged in a relationship with God, unless we're doing those things first and foremost because it's out of worship to Him, just like the Jewish people, it can be vain worship. That's something Jesus tells us about it. In Matthew chapter 23, He tells us something else about worship. He tells us in the first couple of verses that the Jewish religious leaders were sitting in Moses' seat. Now, Moses' seat was actually a literal physical place in every synagogue where they worship God on Sabbath. They had in every synagogue, as far as we know, a seat that was up at front where when the teacher sat down to teach the congregation, he would sit. And it was called Moses' seat. And it was called that because for that moment, that point in time, that person doing the teaching was speaking for Moses in the place of Moses. And very interestingly, Jesus says concerning this, again, Matthew chapter 23, Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must obey them and do everything they tell you." Here's Jesus telling us something else about worship, that we must do God's will. We must listen to God's word and obey it. But he wasn't finished on that subject. He says, "But do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach." Sometimes people won't listen to the word of God because the messenger is flawed. The messenger himself is not doing what he's telling others to do. So Jesus says, don't imitate that messenger, but you still do God's commands. You still do what God said, even if sometimes those commands are being spoken by someone with a very flawed life. Then a little further down in chapter 23, starting about verse 34, I think it is. No, that's not true. I'm a little too far. Verse 23, Matthew 23:23. "Woe to you, teachers of the law and the Pharisees, you hypocrites! You give a tenth of your spices, mint and dill and cumin, but you have neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith." Jesus condemned them for focusing on some little seemingly fairly minute things. They'd even gone to the point that they would go out into their garden and the spices they grew in the corners away from their main, you know, crop. They would have these little spices they would raise of mint and anise and dill and cumin and so forth. They would even, as they carefully picked off the seeds from that, from which they would make their spices, they would carefully tithe. One out of every 10 seeds went to God. At first, we'd be very impressed with that. Here's people who are very careful to do just what God commanded. But Jesus said actually the opposite. While they were focusing on the minute, they had skipped the very big things of God's commandments. Things having to do with doing justice and being merciful and being faithful or full of faith. "You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former. You blind guides, you strain out a gnat but swallow a camel." Now Jesus says you shouldn't be swallowing the camel, but you still should be straining out the gnat. He said, yes, it's right. God can appreciate the devotion someone would have to even tithe the little extra things in their garden, but not if they neglect the most important things. Jesus is telling us something else about worship. Sometimes we can get so upset, perhaps, that maybe something in our service wasn't done just right. And, you know, the issues are different at different times. What we really should be upset about is if justice and mercy and faithfulness isn't present. Those other things are important if they have to do with God's Word. But there are certain fundamental things that are really important. And Jesus talked about those in chapter 22, just the chapter before this, when someone came to him and said, "Teacher, what's the most important commandment in the law?" And of course, this is going to have to do with worship, because a big part of the law, almost 1/6 of the commandments in the law, between the Ten Commandments and all the 603 or whatever it was, other commandments he gave in the law, 1/6 of them at least had to do with worship. And perhaps they thought when they asked him this question, what's the most important commandment in the law, they thought he would say, well, keeping the Sabbath day, or having no other gods before me. But what was his answer? "Thou shalt love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength." And the second most important commandment is just like it, he says. Love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus is telling us something about worship. He's letting us know the most important issues, even in worship, have to do with loving God with all of our being. It's not so much on the external as on the internal. And if we don't love our neighbor as we love ourselves, Jesus tells us in other passages we could look at, that nullifies our worship to God. He even tells in the Sermon on the Mount that if we are bringing our offering to the altar, but you realize that you and your brother have something amiss between you, He says, leave your offering there. Don't even offer it yet. Go get it straightened out. Will your brother then come back and make the offering to God? Isn't that Jesus telling us something about worship? What the most important things are? The kind of heart we have, the kind of relationship we have both to God and to others, really having a big effect upon our worship. There's a lot more we could say about this and what Jesus tells us about worship. These are just the things He taught. But just think for a moment. He was willing to be totally submissive to what God had ordained for His generation and for His time to do that would be acceptable worship. Jesus was up at the temple for the great holy days. He was there with all the others. He knew that geographically, that the temple wasn't any more important than any other place truly in the mind of God. But God had ordained that until He dies on the cross as a place where people worship. So He was there. He was circumcised at 8 days old. At 40 days old, He was with His parents as they carried Him in their arms up to the temple so His mother could fulfill the commandments of the law. At age 12, He was there with His parents, not just to keep one of the great feast days, but probably also to fulfill His bar mitzvah, to become a man in the house of Israel. Jesus, throughout His entire life, kept God's commandments concerning worship for the Jewish people of His day. He kept Sabbath day. We find Him in the synagogues. He would even challenge those who would accuse Him of being a blasphemer or whatever and say, which of you can convict me of even one sin? And that whole discussion was in the context of whether He kept Sabbath day or not. Jesus kept the law that God had ordained. He didn't use the fact that He knew what was truly important to God, and that was the heart and the spirit and the true. He didn't use that as an excuse to then neglect what God had commanded all people to do, and therefore including Him. And so He kept the Sabbath. He was at the temple. He even drove the money changers and merchants out of the temple because He said they had turned God's house from a house of prayer and a place where Gentiles could come and learn about God into a den of thieves. Jesus prayed. Jesus praised. Jesus participated in all those things that not only showed outwardly that He believed in worshiping God, but showed what kind of heart He had. We can learn a great deal from Jesus about worship, both in what He said and in what He did. We are the true worshipers today if we worship God in the spiritual and according to the true, just like Jesus said. Don has an invitation song for us to allow us to think about these things and, in fact, our whole life. Because as Jesus Himself said, it's out of the heart that man brings forth those things that either condemn him and pollute him or that commend him and make him pleasing to God. So if any of us this morning need to do something to respond to the invitation, you can come and do that now while we stand up and sing the song.